Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I want to use this opportunity to talk about some project, to talk briefly about some project I've been working on. I won't have time to go into detail, but I will be very happy to discuss any of that with you if you're interested. I should also mention that my project were not directly related to evolution, but I've been interested, and it's the reason why I'm here, mostly to learn this stuff. I'm a physicist. I've been working on modeling a biological system, mainly developmental processes. We know that during development, cells collectively organize to form patterns and structures which are well defined and conserved. And the question is how the patterns are formed. One example of pattern formation can be studied at the boundaries. We know that different tissues may have populations of different cell types. And boundaries cell types are defined by the genes or proteins that, or signals each population express. And then the boundaries are where different population meet and sometimes interact and, you know, they can communicate. And it's why boundaries are important, because they can be considered as some signaling center in many tissues. Then there are different aspects of boundaries which are interesting, and then they raise some interesting questions. First, of course, about signaling near the boundaries, how different genes, protein signals work together to build up signaling pathway or gene regulatory networks, and it's interesting to know how it works. Of course, the morphology of boundaries are also important. We know that in many tissues, boundaries keep precise morphologies. In many tissues, it's very straight. And it's interesting to know how it's developed and why it should be so precise. And then when different populations meet, there could be cell competition, and it's interesting to study this as well. And of course, to understand the system, such a system, we need to know the signaling pathway, how different proteins and genes interact with each other, or signals are produced. We use actually such a model to describe the boundaries in plant development, we use the model to describe a gene regulatory network which is important in shaping the leaf contour.
Are you interested in cell competition at intimate boundaries where there's
continuity? I will discuss cell competition later. Okay. First, it's just about signaling. But I'm not going to discuss it now. Apart from signaling, then the mechanics and growth of tissues is also important to have a full picture of what's going on. We can just put mechanical properties of cells in a model, and we just use it to simulate the growth of tissues at the level of cells. We use such a model to look at the morphology of boundaries, how it's precise, and we use such a model to explain which mechanism contribute to the to shaping of boundaries in Drosophila wing imaginal disk. Again, I would skip this one and to just go to cell competition. And we propose a simple model which can describe cell competition in some tissues. You know, it's sort of cell competition. And we assume we have two types of cells, A cells and B cells. On the left, we have A cells, right, B cells, and in the middle, that can mix a little bit near the boundary. And we just use some basic ideas from physics to develop a model describing such a system. And we start from balance of cell numbers. It can be written like this for A cells. Okay. This shows, I mean, NA is actually the density of the number of A cells in a volume, you know, per volume. And then the changes during time is given by the fluxes to the volume, described by the velocity of these cells, you know. And this is balanced by cell division in this volume. Ka is actually the division rate, the effective division rate of cells, and is in fact division minus apoptosis or death rate. And it's shown that I mean previously it's shown that cell division rate can depend on the pressure, hydrostatic pressure of the system. And then people define, I mean, you can imagine that if we apply higher pressure, cells tend to divide less and the inverse. And then the homeostatic pressure is defined as the pressure where the effective division stops. So division rate, division and death balance each other. And then near this homeostatic pressure, one can use an approximation for division rate, you know, something like that. pH is just the homeostatic pressure, and P is the pressure, the hydrostatic pressure of the system. So a linear relation can be used, and kappa is just a constant. All these equations can be written for B cells as well. I just wrote it for A. But we consider, in our problem, we consider the situation where homeostatic pressure of A cells and B cells are different. So we assume that, for instance, A cells are stronger and they can tolerate higher pressure. So we just do some mathematical calculation and we come up with the equation, we describe the dynamics of the system. Something like that for phi, which is the volume fraction of A cells. Equals to, sorry. A bit long, but I mean, it describes the time evolution of phi at any position. Phi is the volume fraction of A cells. We assume all the volume is filled by A cells or B cells, so one minus phi is the volume fraction of B cells. So I will describe different terms of this equation. If we just look at these three terms, it looks very much like the classical Fisher wave. And then it says that the changes of phi, the volume fraction, is given by diffusion and then the interaction term. Here, the interaction comes from differences in the homeostatic pressure of these two types of cells. And however, we have an extra term compared to the Fisher's wave, and it's a mechanical term. V is the velocity, the average velocity of cells, and this for solving this equation and having we need another equation which we just take from force balance. And force balance is just this simple equation which just says that the divergence of a stress tensor is balanced by the friction force with the substrate. So the stress tensor is actually, the stress is just, you know, pressure other terms, you know, just some simple term, viscosity and pressure mainly, and it can also include interfacial terms.
This
pressure is different from the hydrostatic pressure that you talk
about? It's exactly the same as hydrostatic pressure, but this is homeostatic pressure, which is just a characteristic of cell. You know, it's but this pressure depends on position, you know, where we are. So, so we just, I mean, we can solve the equations. We can just do some calculation and solve the equation. But the interesting point is that such equations have a traveling wave solution. It means if we have x here, x is, we have such a profile for phi. And phi equals 1, it means A cells. Phi equals 0, B cells. And then here we have a mixture at near the boundary. And then all this wave is traveling with a velocity c, which is constant, almost constant, I mean, even if there are noises. And then, I mean, we can just see it in this picture that here, A cells, the homeostatic A cells are stronger, and then they divide more near the boundary. B cells divide less, and A population is invading B population. The interesting parameter here is the velocity c, which is actually characterized by parameters of the model. In a simplified version, we can just describe the system with two dimensionless parameters, and then we have a phase space. I don't want to discuss the details of parameters, but the important point is that at one region of parameters, we have the velocity, I mean, the velocity of the wave equals to the Fisher's wave velocity in the dimensionless form. And the other, in the other region, actually, I can write it here, we can get higher wave velocities. So, I mean, for some other parameters, we can, the A population can invade with higher speeds into the B population. This is called, I mean, pulling front. Here, the linearities in front tail coming mostly from diffusion. Are giving the velocity, the speed of the wave, and in the other regime, the non-linearities from back, the mechanical terms are important, and they are actually pushing the wave with a higher velocity. And yeah, that's the main conclusion. Yeah.
What are the x's?
This one, yeah, I mean, I didn't put because, you know, I just said we have two dimensionless parameters, two characteristic parameters. I mean, I can write it down, but they are a bit massive. Just.
So I was going to ask the same. Can you say in words?
For example?
What situation is in the top part of your on the right side of one or something?
For example, I mean, you know, here we have some parameters, some free parameters. This kappa for, I mean, here, and then this mu, and then in the stress we have the viscosity in the system, and then we just combine different these parameters together to have two dimensionless free parameters. I actually don't remember exactly. But
if it cells with high viscosity and they fall into this part of your graph.
Actually, it's more complicated. Yeah. These dimensionless parameters are quite complicated. Just having different terms. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, maybe, I mean, if diffusion is more, so I expect it to be more similar. I mean, diffusion is more, you know. Is it stronger, yeah, then probably we are in this regime, yeah.
Go ahead. So I had a question about this velocity v. So where does the movement come from? Is it sort of external forces that push these cells around, or
No, they are just, you know, we have this velocity for each component, And then we define the average velocity and the
rate. Yeah, but where does the velocity come from? So
I mean,
the cells actively move or?
The cells can move, you know, not, I mean, yeah, actively or, I mean, in the continuum limit, they just, we assume they have a velocity. I mean, it also comes from activity. When cells divide in each volume, if the concentration of cells is constant, then cells move. So it has an active, it can have an active, you know, reason for motion. But in general, they can move. I mean, you know, just the velocity.
I'm just trying to understand whether that's an external parameter that you set from.
No, it's not external. It's actually just.
It's part of the.
Yeah, it's the part of the picture. Yeah. It's,
so
we solve it. We calculate V from this equation.
The external parameters are these P's, P and mu.
So external parameters are this kappa, delta pH, diffusion, and mu, and then another one for viscosity in stress. Yeah, but we combine them to have just two. Dimensionless
model. So maybe two more quick questions.
This is a one-dimensional model. What would happen if you do this in two or three dimensions? Is the boundary, does it stay smooth, or is there an instability and starts to form?
Actually, yeah, it does. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's 1D, and we actually assume it's symmetric along this direction. But of course, we can add noises to the system. I mean, in this version, there is no, you know, noise except for diffusion.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we haven't done the noise part yet. Yeah. But, yeah. That's.
What is the significance? Sorry, to interrupt. What's the significance of the c greater than 2 part of phase space? Right. So c equal to 2 is exactly a Fisher wave. Is that right?
Yeah.
So if v were 0, then the whole phase space would be dominated. It would be the c equals 2.
Even for some V's, that's
even for some V's.
Some V's, yeah, we can get Fisher's wave speed.
So how should I think? So I know how to think about a Fisher wave, right? It's basically what you drew. But how do I think about the C greater than 2 type wave? Is it qualitatively different, or is it just?
No, actually, it's also a moving front with a constant speed. But the speed is higher than the Fisher wave. And actually, these solutions are valid when we start from a sharp initial condition. I should mention that. But I mean, for the Fisher wave, we always have c equals 2 if we start with such an initial condition. It's the selected velocity. And here we can have higher velocity. So invasion can happen faster, you know. But they are very similar qualitatively. Sorry, I forgot to mention that we also look at other dimensions. We also look at other geometries like polar geometry and yeah. But we can discuss it later.
Yeah, we can discuss more of this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Wait.
We're going out. We're going.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So our next speaker is Diana Davidson. She got her PhD. She was an undergraduate at UC Davis. She studied animal biology, biology of primates.
Yes.
Then she saw the light. She got her master's degree in at the University of Bath, where she studied evolutionary biology and development, and she's now a PhD student with Rick at the University of Arizona, and she's just starting her second year of graduate school. And the title of her talk is Morphological Complexity and Stress Responsivity in the Volusine Algae.
Is the projector?
Is it on? It was on a minute ago.
Yeah,
it's late.
It went to sleep.
Perfect. All right. All set. It's up. Oh, it was up. There we go. Yeah.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you. So across the tree of life, we see substantial variation in organismal complexity, from prokaryotes to eukaryotes to multicellular organisms, to organisms with complex multicellularity, so multiple cell types, to those that are forming complex social structures. Within just the vulvocene algae, we see a range of complexity with unicellular Chlamydomonas reinhardtii, being one example of an organism with very low complexity, but then moving up in the complexity gradients and quantifying complexity in terms of number of cell types, body size, and number of cells. Looking at uterine elegans, which just has one cell type, so a number of Chlamydomonas-like cells suspended in extracellular matrix. And moving on to Pleiadrinus starii, which has reproductive cells that are like these uterina cells, but then fully differentiated somatic cells, all suspended in the extracellular matrix. So in us, our somatic cells are anything that is not a germ cell or reproductive cells. These are just differentiated non-reproductive cells. And then in a species like Vovox carteri, you have two fully differentiated cell types. These germ cells, which are the reproductive cells, and then somatic cells. And in species such as Vovox russellii, you can go up to 50,000 cells in a small colonial organism. And I should note that I will be focusing on the reproductive cells today as a phenotype of interest in studying how the number of reproductive cells changes in response to stress in these different species. So the reproductive cells are just the large ones in the colonies that have multiple cell types and just the only kind of cell in uterina. So the vulvocene green algae are found in freshwater ponds and lakes, and they're subjected to a variety of environmental stressors. So these are conditions that perturb organismal homeostasis. And these stressors include nutrient deprivation, temperature fluctuations, and water availability, or lack thereof. And although I won't be focusing on this in the short time I have here, I do want to note that environmental stress does select for multicellularity and cellular differentiation. So in 1859, Darwin observed that simpler organisms tend to be more variable than more complex organisms, organisms with cellular differentiation. Similarly, work done by Siegel and Bergman and others have found that complex gene networks are more robust to mutations. So when you have gene networks with higher connectivity, when those gene networks experience a mutation, you don't see substantial changes in gene expression levels. So I predict that more complex species will exhibit fewer changes in reproductive cell number, my phenotype of interest, in response to stress. So I'm asking two questions in the study. First, do vulvocene green algae species differ in the extent to which they display variability in the number of reproductive cells? And if they do, does the degree of morphological complexity, so again, that's number of cells, body size, and cellular differentiation, does complexity affect the extent to which they respond to stress? So when I'm talking about response to stress, I'm talking again about changes in the number of reproductive cells. And there's two ways in which the number of reproductive cells can change. You can have changes in the mean number of reproductive cells. So this is just a schematic showing how the number of reproductive cells may change in response to stress. So here you see changes in the mean number of reproductive cells, or plastic changes. And here as well you see changes in the mean. But you can also see changes in the level of variability in the number of reproductive cells. Right, so here, there's no changes in the mean, but there's changes in the level of variability. And on the y-axis here, you have number of reproductive cells. And here you have changes in both the mean number of reproductive cells and the level of variability in reproductive cell number, or you can have no changes at all. And we have very low levels of variability. This is called, and then transition to having high levels of variability. We consider this to be changes in canalization. So you're going from a canalized stable state to a decanalized state with lots of variability, but I'll stay away from that jargon. So I'm conducting a pilot study right now, and I have data from 3 species thus far, although I will be expanding this so it's a much broader comparative study. So right now, I have data for Uterine elegans, which is my simplest species with 1 cell type and a maximum number of 32 cells. I have Pleiadrina californica, which has 1 undifferentiated cell type, the GS cells, which are the reproductive cells, and 1 differentiated cell type, the somatic cells, and a maximum number of 128 cells. And my most complex species is Volvox carteri, which again has 2 fully differentiated cell types and a maximum of 5,000 cells. And these species are all closely related in this one clade here. So I'm subjecting these individuals to a number of different stressors. So I have 4 different temperature treatments. I'm only showing you 1 here for the sake of time, this 0 degrees C temperature treatment. And for reference, they're typically grown at 25 degrees C. And then I'm subjecting another treatment to a continuous nitrogen deprivation. And of course, I have controls. I have 2 flasks per treatment. And I'm collecting data on the F1 generation. So what does that mean? So that means I stress out this organism here. And then I'm counting the number of reproductive cells when these cells hatch out, right? So each one of these dark spots here are reproductive cells. They hatch and they go on to develop, and then I count the number of reproductive cells in them. So I'm looking at the offspring of the individuals that I stressed.
So each of these cells will generate the whole colony?
Yes, will go on to generate the whole colony. Well, I'm looking at the next generation here. And I used this instrument called a FlowCam to collect my data. So it takes images of the colonies, and then I'm counting the number of reproductive cells. It also collects additional phenotype data, but that's not shown here. So I'm looking at changes in the mean number of reproductive cells again, and the level of variability in reproductive cells. And I'm also looking at the baseline levels of variability present. So within my control treatments, looking at the coefficient of variation, which is just the standard deviation divided by the mean. So my first species is Uterina elegans, and remember this is the simplest species of the 3 that I've collected data on thus far. And I found that the mean number of reproductive cells, so this is the number of reproductive cells, here are my treatments, control, 0 degrees C, nitrogen deprivation, and the white dots represent the means here, the black lines are medians, just a bar chart with whiskers. And I found that the mean number of reproductive cells in these stress treatments doesn't differ from controls. And additionally, the level of variability in the number of reproductive cells in the 2 stress treatments doesn't differ from controls. And you have a coefficient of variation for the controls of 0.295. So I'm not seeing any changes in reproductive cell number in response to stress. And Pleiadrina californica, which is my species of intermediate complexity, so it has 1 differentiated cell type but undifferentiated reproductive cells. I see changes in the mean number of reproductive cells in response to stress. So there's a decrease in the mean in both the 0 degrees C treatment and the nitrogen deprivation treatments. But I don't see any significant changes in the level of variability relative to controls. And I tested for this using Levine's test. When I look at the level of variability in the controls, I have a coefficient of variation of 0.286, which is very similar to what I saw in Uterina, interestingly. So Roblox carteri, which is my most complex species with two different cell types, fully differentiated cell types. I see changes in the mean number of reproductive cells in response to stress. Again, those are the white dots there. And changes in the level of variability in response to stress. So if you look at the controls, you'll notice there's no large green box here. That's because it's all collapsed, this one black line. The first and the third quartiles are overlapping. So you have very low levels of baseline variability in the controls here. So in summary, again, I looked at these three species, with Euterina being the simplest, and Volvox being the most complex. I found that Euterina and Pleiadrina had very similar levels of baseline variability in reproductive cell number, whereas Volvox carteri had a much lower number of variability in these controls. I found that Euterina shows changes in the mean number of reproductive cells and the variability in the number of reproductive cells in response to stress, no changes for Euterina. You see changes in the mean, but not in the level of variability for Pleiadrina, which is my intermediate species. And my most complex species, Volvox carteri, I see changes in both the mean number of reproductive cells and the level of variability in reproductive cells. So going back, remember my question here is morphological complexity associated with stress responsivity? So this is just a schematic of my hypothesis going forward that I'm going to test by increasing the number of species used in the study. Thus far, with the three species I've looked at for the pilot portion of the study, I found that three data points, right? The most complex species shows changes in variability and in the mean. So again, this will be my hypothesis that I'm testing going forward from here. So I'll be increasing the number of species and really focusing on this relationship between responsivity and complexity. I'm also altering some of my experimental treatments to add in different additional temperatures, and including measures of stress and health, including growth rate. Also be collecting some additional phenotype data, including number of somatic cells, and improving my image analysis. And finally, I'll be adding a multi-generational component, looking at the changes several generations following the stressor, not just one generation. So I'd like to thank all the members of the Michaud Lab, Rick, Patrick Ferris, Eric Hanschen, and Zach, as well as Christian Solari and Jim Uman. And of course, I want to thank funding sources Arizona, NASA, and SF, and the Copley Institute, and all of you.
We have two minutes for questions.
Okay, perfect.
Did the CV and the stressed Volvox achieve the 30% level that you got in the others?
So, I have data for that. So these are the coefficients of variation for Volvox, Pleiadrina, and Elegans, and even under stress, it's still a bit lower than what you see for the controls, but I haven't done any F-tests here to see if those differences are significant. But, I mean, it's going up to this 20 to 30% range. And I suspect that the 20 degrees C and 33 degrees C treatments are not stressful for the Volvox. Yeah?
But for the Volvox, you're showing that you have differences in means and in variance. And I was wondering whether your effect on the mean has helped you to the variance.
Yes. So
maybe it's only variance that's changing and not the mean. And from the graph you are showing, the means look very small.
Yes. So in order to avoid having the mean be a confounding factor, I use a couple of different tests. First, I use the coefficient of variation, and then coupled that with an F-test to look for significant differences between them. And the results I showed here were from Levine's test, which accounts for differences in the mean. So let's see.
I think my question was the other way around. Do you really have a difference in the mean?
Do I really have differences?
I mean, you have a very obvious difference in the variance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the difference in the mean is pretty small, so it's significant at the 0.05 level.
Yeah, but I wonder whether that significance is not due to the variance, not the mean.
Hmm.
Because because that's the problem with the high-rise. Sometimes the effect is significant, but it's just the variance.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I'll take a look at that to make sure that the changes in the mean aren't being accounted for by the changes in the variance. Good point. Yeah.
So in your second species, the arena, right? Mm-hmm. So the mean went down. The mean of these reproductive cells went down with stress, whereas in the Volvox it went up.
Yeah.
Do you have any explanation for that?
I don't have any good explanation for that. That's a really good point. I should know that the developmental programs in Volvox carteri is really different from that seen in other species, and they have asymmetric division, which could be playing a role in how they're responding to these stressors. But no, I...
It would be interesting to come up with one.
That would,
and many species, I think.
When I'm doing a larger comparative analysis, I'll have a number of Volvox species with different developmental programs, so very different developments, and I'll be able to determine whether the extent to which these different aspects of development are affecting responsivity.
Okay, one more quick question.
Yeah, it's just like, when you said this, I still don't understand. What, so those are the reproductive cells, and they're also green, so that's the ones that do also photosynthesis?
Yeah, so these are all reproductive cells here.
And the other
as are these. These are green, they just look darker because of the differences in magnification. Everything looks darker when it comes out of the slow cam. All of these cells, yes, they're doing photosynthesis.
Also the reproductive cells.
The reproductive cells are doing photosynthesis, yeah. So chloroplast biogenesis is actually substantially downregulated in these small somatic cells.
It's downregulated.
Yeah.
So they both
reproduce
and do photosynthesis,
specialized cells. So in these, you have two different types of specialized cells. You have these germ cells, which don't have any flagella, that are largely specialized for reproduction. And you have these somatic cells, where you have chloroplast biogenesis downregulated, and they don't go on to reproduce.
So you can continue this, ladies. Okay, great. So our next speaker is Einav. He was an undergraduate at Rice University in Houston, and he is now a PhD student with Rob Phillips, and he's starting his third year of graduate school. And the title of his talk is Two Cute Problems in Enzyme Kinetics.
What a cute title.
What a cute title.
Thank you.
So I'll let you know when you're
home. Sweet. Let's see. Okay. All right. Allostery is a major theme of the Rob Phillips lab, and indeed of my own research as well. So allostery is the idea that a molecule can exist in two different conformations. So my hand can be wiggling in an open state, or it can be wiggling in a closed state, and it can go back and forth between them. And that's the whole thing. That's the whole idea, is that it just switches between two states back and forth the whole time. And this very simple idea has really far-reaching implications, so it opens up very rich dynamics. And it's seen everywhere in biology. It's seen everywhere from simple ligands binding to receptors. Receptors are oftentimes allosteric. It's seen from chemotactic networks. It's seen in ion-gated ligand channels. It's just seen everywhere in biology. And so you can ask questions like, is it convergent evolution? Did it appear everywhere independently? Why does it seem that biology uses allostery so often as its means to achieve different biological functions? And for an interested audience member, I would really highly recommend, Rob gave a nice talk about this 5 weeks ago here at KITP, so that would be a great place for the curious person to start looking at different ways that allostery is present in biology. I'm going to talk about enzymes in particular and see what allostery can do and what you can answer with allostery and what interesting phenomenon occur. So I'm going to start off with very simple enzymes, no allostery, just the plain vanilla enzyme system. So we have an enzyme, and it binds to a substrate, and they form a complex where they're nice and happy together. And from this complex, the enzyme can form product. And in this case, I'll just draw it as an example, as product means that the enzyme cuts the substrate in half, but so much more can happen. So we have our enzyme, and we have our substrate, which I'll denote by S, and we have our product. So enzymes can add, bend, twist, but just to give us something concrete to think about, you can think of it as a chopper. It goes and cleaves two things in half. So one nice question you can ask is, what happens when we increase the concentration of substrate? How does this affect the rate at which product is made? In other words, you can think of this as the speed of the enzyme. How fast does it work? So if you have no substrate, you can make no product. And then if you increase the substrate, you're going to make product faster and faster and faster. And that makes sense because the enzyme is over here and the substrate's wiggling around. And only once they find each other in the exact right spot can you cleave the substrate to make product. So if you just have more substrate in the system, then the probability at any given point in time that you get a substrate in the right spot increases. So you're going to go faster and faster and faster. But eventually, the enzyme will go as fast as it can, and you're going to saturate to a roughly horizontal line. So this is what I would call the expected curve, which makes it very interesting whenever instead you see a curve that starts going up and then has a peak and goes down. So this occurs in some enzymes, and it's a funny, strange, some might even call it cute puzzle of why is there a peak in this curve that should not really have a peak. So this is one case, and there are many other cases of peaks. I'm going to introduce one more, but before I do, substrate is not the only kind of molecule that occurs with enzymes. There's a lot of other things competing for the exact same slot, and we're going to call these other things competitive inhibitors. So a competitive inhibitor.
One quick question. Does data, this, both of these curves are from in vitro data?
Yes, they are from in vitro data. That's correct. All right, so we could also have, instead of just a plain old substrate, we could also have a competitive inhibitor, which also binds to the exact same spot in the enzyme. But the difference is that the competitive inhibitor can't be cut. So the competitive inhibitor can just be thought of as a blocker. Inhibitor. We'll denote it by C. And so it just gets in there, binds to the same site, and until it leaves, the substrate can't come in and be cut. So we just expect that this thing competes with substrate and inhibits the reaction, and it can just be as a blocker in your mind. So you can ask the same kind of question. If we have here as a function now, not of substrate, but as competitive inhibitor, what is the speed of the enzyme? How fast does it make product? And we're going to go ahead and do this at some fixed concentration of substrate. OK, so at no competitor and some fixed concentration of substrate, the enzyme is going at some speed. And then the important thing is, as you add more and more competitor, you expect for the reaction to go slower and slower and slower. Because all that happens is a competitor comes in, binds more and more frequently. Eventually, it outcompetes the substrate completely, because it's just so common that the substrate can never really bind to the enzyme, and you get no product whatsoever. Which makes it very interesting that instead of this expected behavior, some enzymes actually exhibit a peak before they give the trough. So this data is just absolutely bizarre because this object, which only comes in here and blocks and competes and inhibits, is actually somehow activating an enzyme. So that's just very counterintuitive to, especially to my physics-y oriented way of thinking. So how do we solve these two? Does the same enzyme do both? That's a great question. The same enzyme can indeed do both the orange curve and the blue curve simultaneously. But that's a totally separate question but excellent point. OK, so how can we explain this kind of behavior? I'm going to go ahead and introduce two.
Can the white curve enzyme do a blue curve?
Yes. Actually, all four are possible. OK, so I'm going to introduce two different details to this enzyme. First thing, I'm going to not just have a one-site enzyme, but I'm going to have a two-site enzyme. So two independent sites. Both of them can grab substrate. Both of them can cleave substrate and make product. And I'm going to introduce allostery, the whole crux of this talk. So allostery means that this enzyme exists in two different conformations. If I take a million pictures of this enzyme, I can actually physically see which state it's in. And if I take a million pictures, it might be 60% of the time in this state and 40% of the time in that state. Let's differentiate them with some names. I'll call this one the inactive state. And I'll call this one the active state. And the reason why is because if the inactive state cuts substrate at some speed, then the active state cuts it at 100 times that speed, way, way faster. So I'll call the active state the one that's really churning away, chopping up the substrate very quickly, and the inactive state is slow and steady. All right, so the enzyme flips back and forth between them all the time. It's not just one or the other, it's both. Not simultaneously, but anytime you look again, it could be in either one. So what happens if you take a million pictures and you see that the enzyme is mostly in the inactive state? I would say that the enzyme energetically favors the inactive state. This state has a lower energy, so most of the time you'll see the enzyme in this energetically favorable state, but still this enzyme can exist sometimes in the active state. Okay, so how can we use this to answer these cute little puzzles? So let me just crudely divide this graph into three regions here, which I'll just call low, medium, and high concentration of competitive inhibitor. And let's assume that the enzyme starts off in the inactive state. So alone, by itself, the enzyme highly prefers the inactive state to the active state. So it'll be here. There's some substrate present. So it'll be binding to some substrate. And it'll really strongly prefer the inactive state. Inactive and active enzyme. Once you add some competitive inhibitor, the competitive inhibitor will start binding to the enzyme. And let's assume that the competitive inhibitor has a greater affinity for the active state rather than the inactive state. So although the enzyme by itself would like to be in the inactive state, the competitive inhibitor would really like to bind it in the active state. It's more energetically favorable to make a complex with the active state rather than the inactive state. So two processes compete. And so the competitive inhibitor will pull some of the enzyme towards the active state. So what you get now is maybe 50% of the enzyme is inactive, and 50% is active. So now it's bound not only to substrate, but also to a competitive inhibitor. And at really, really high concentrations of competitive inhibitor, you would expect that the competitive inhibitor outcompetes the substrate. So all the enzyme is going to be in the active state, and it'll be doubly bound to competitive inhibitor. So does this cartoon explain the graph underneath? So at really high concentrations, you expect that there's no substrate bound to the enzyme. So basically, you expect no product to be made. So that makes sense. At low concentrations, you expect some product to be made, because the enzyme is bound to substrate. But at the middle concentration, not only is some enzyme bound to substrate, but some active enzyme is bound to substrate. And that's going to induce a peak because the enzyme right here works even faster than this enzyme. So you expect to get a peak and then eventually a trough. So I would say that this is a cartoon explanation of what could possibly be happening underneath. Yes? OK, so I'm going.
Why do you need only two states to explain a model? There should be the whole ensemble of states with different activities.
OK, you can absolutely do more. But we're always looking for the simplest model that can explain a phenomenon. And so absolutely, you can have three states, five, a bajillion, and you can get even more rich behavior, absolutely. But if two states explains it, and two states is easy to grasp for my physicist brain again to do, then that's where we begin. And the same question could be asked with why only two active sites and not six or eight, because perfectly valid question. So I'm going to say that I'll just leave this as an exercise for the enthusiastic audience member. It's the exact same thing. You can come up with a scheme of does the active state or the inactive state dominate at low regimes, and then what happens is substrate binds, and you can make the exact analogous cartoon to that case, which explained this peak as well.
So the binding of the competitor doesn't cause the enzyme to go into the active state?
It does. It's when the enzyme binds that there's an energy.
Okay.
Yeah, there's an energy between the enzyme and the competitive inhibitor. Yes?
But you do need to have two sides.
You do, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And I'll get back to that. With one, it just doesn't work. And without allosteric, it doesn't work. Okay, so I'm gonna just leave you with two final points on what it really means to do a theory paper about this kind of stuff. So the way that our theory paper proceeds is we build up a model for how do you actually model a substrate and a competitive inhibitor, and what happens if you have two sites, and what happens if you have allostery. And we build them up one component at a time, and then we can ask ourselves, what's the most general form if we have two sites, a substrate, a competitor, and allostery, what's the most general form for this dP/dt curve? And we can ask, when does it have a peak? Which is a very simple question. We can ask, when does the derivative equal zero? When does that have an actual real root? And so you get from that a relation. You get that the ratio of the energies must be less than some ratio of the affinities of the competitor and the substrate. And it's a very nice result. And from that result, you can make a cartoon. So that's nice, because then you can really feel like you understood. There's a simple story that explains. But you can go further than that. You can say, is the cartoon the whole story? And not surprisingly, it turns out that it's not the whole story. So you get a lot of really interesting predictions that you can actually make experimentally. So for example, the enzyme does not have to be predominantly in the inactive state here in this low regime. And even more interestingly, if the competitive inhibitor has the same exact affinity for the active state and the inactive state, it can still make a peak like this. So that, you know, just to give you some fun things to think about. So the last point I want to make is, as pointed out, this phenomenon can't actually happen without two important things, the two sites, not just the one site, and without allostery. Both of them are important to make this particular story work out. There might be other means to make a peak over there, but for this particular mechanism, you need two sites, because the competitive inhibitor actually blocks up this site. So if there's only one site and it blocks it up, you're hosed. You can't make any more product. And similarly, you need allostery, because if you just had the active state and there was no inactive state to switch to, you just don't find any kind of peak shape. So at the conclusion, these two phenomena, as an interested audience member would find over there, actually rely on both allostery and having multiple sites. So it's this interesting idea that if you have a bunch of very simple processes, these are, in my view, four simple processes, a substrate binding, a competitor binding, two sites, and allostery, you get very rich dynamics that you would not ordinarily predict, dynamics which I would say are very counterintuitive and potentially cute puzzles to solve. No, absolutely identical. Completely identical and independent. Yes?
So could you still, you just said it doesn't work with two, but if you sort of would have the rate at which you switch between allostery and the speed of the reaction in the most active state, you could still find a window where it would be possible to have this peak. That would be at the moment where the competitor would.
Unbinds?
Yeah, it would, at the moment where it unbinds, since you have more of the active state, you still have enough time to process.
Absolutely. So there are other mechanisms and means. In this particular simple model, what we assume is as soon as the competitor unbinds, you instantly get equilibrium, which means that there's no lingering effects like that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no question that even with one site alone and the model that you just proposed, you can get peaks.
Why would an enzyme want to have an inactive state anyway?
Excellent question. So why is a very good question. And one answer that I can give you is it might want this shape. It might want a peak. And so there's a very cute paper on substrate inhibition. That's what this phenomenon is called, where a whole bunch of substrate actually decreases activity. And it turns out that as many as 20% of enzymes actually obey this kind of thing. That's a huge number. And so you might ask, why in the world do they do that? I mean, that's a significant chunk of enzymes doing this. And so there are papers showing that if you have this kind of behavior, you actually have more fluid input output. You're better able to handle noise, and you're able to just react very differently, as you can imagine, from that case. So the why question is very interesting and has a lot of evolutionary applications, and I would be happy to talk about it afterwards.
Okay. So we'll postpone the rest of the questions till
Okay.
You'll be here the rest of the
week. Absolutely.
I think all of you will be here all next week.
I'm here till next week.
Okay, great.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so our next speaker is Kun Shim.
Yep.
Okay. He got his undergraduate degree from Peking University in biotechnology. He got a master's degree in also at the same university in chemical biology. And now he's a PhD student with Joanna at the University of Arizona. And he is starting his third year of graduate school. And he's going to talk to us about his project, a toy model on the evolution of transcription factor networks.
It's great cooperation. So, it's really a pleasure to be here to present my project to every one of you. So, actually, I got this project first, but it turned out to be the most challenging one. So, what I can tell you now is I just finished building the model, so there's really no data yet. But still, I want to gather inputs from you so that I can make potential modifications to the model or find more applications to the model. So I will be talking about transcription factor network. So let's start from something that's basic. I'll use this to explain what I mean by transcription factor network. So when you look at a gene, usually in front of that is a promoter, followed by the gene itself. So biology tells us that when the transcription factor binds to the promoter, assuming this is an activating transcription factor, it leads to the expression of gene. Now in my case, the product of this gene is actually another transcription factor. I will call this one transcription factor A, and this one transcription factor B. And as you can imagine, transcription factor B can bind to the promoter of another gene. In this case, this another gene actually encodes transcription factor A. This gives our gives us a loop. So to simplify this case, we use a circle to represent transcription factor A. And another circle to represent transcription factor B. Then to describe the relationship between these two transcription factors, we say transcription factor A regulate the expression of transcription factor B, and also transcription factor B did the same to transcription factor A. And now if you add all the transcription factors you can find in an organism, just your few here, you'll have some sort of network. And my project is addressing what is the evolution of this network, how does this network grow, how does it look like under different selections versus under some boring situations where there's really not too much selection on the dynamic of patterns of this network. So to model this, so my model, to give you a global view of the model, so in my model, I have this network, and I have a special protein whose expression is regulated by the whole network. And this protein, its concentration is directly, its concentration directly determines the growth rate of the virtual cell in my model. So now you can imagine this, a mutation changes the pattern in this network, and this can potentially lead to the change in the expression pattern of this protein, and subsequently leads to changes in the growth pattern. So if I put selection on certain growth patterns, I can indirectly select for the changes in this network.
So what makes my model unique is two things. One, it can model a realistic mutation spectrums. The realistic mutation spectrum is very important. As Professor Michael Lynch has pointed out, the different mutation spectrums can potentially alter the structure, the topology of this network here. So to input this realistic mutation spectrum in our model, what we did is, here is the gene, and here's the promoter. We put A, T, C, G, say, let's put somewhere here. We actually track the nucleotides of the promoter in the gene, and let's assume this ATCC is the binding site of transcription factor 1, and this CTTA is the binding site of transcription factor 2. Now, what we can do is we can mutate the binding sequence, say, changes to ATGG, and then this binding site is lost. It's like a removing a connection between these two transcription factors, or we can introduce some smaller mutations that keeps this binding site but changes its affinity to this transcription factor, or we can duplicate the gene along with its promoter. Let's say we duplicate transcription factor B here. And this duplication will keep all the binding site in the promoter. And this will give us, an additional copy of transcription factor B, exactly the same in the network. And the second thing that makes the model special is we model the stochasticity in gene expression. Though this part of the model can be highly variable depending on the purpose of the modeling. So in my case, on top of my list is to test a hypothesis that has something to do with the fluctuations in gene expression. So we put this stochasticity into the model. So to model this stochasticity, we assume that the gene expression has two stages. Stage one, the gene of interest is wrapped around on a nucleosome, so it's closed. Nothing that the transcription machinery have no access to the gene. Under certain, and this state can transfer to a open state where the transcription machinery have access to the gene and produce mRNA. This is a reversible state, a reversible process. Now I have K on here depend that describes how frequent this state can transfer into this state. And this K on is a function of the number of activating transcription factors binds to the promoter and the number of repressive transcription factors that binds to the promoter region. And on this side, that's the K-off rate that basically determines how long this state can stay. And it's also a function of a activating transcription factor and repressive transcription factor. So in this case, if we model this process with some stochastic algorithm, we can introduce fluctuations into the gene expression. I can put protein here. So I can give you an example, or maybe I should give you an example to give you a flavor on how this model works. So if you look at, if you did some literature research, you will find that there are many people interested in something called feed-forward loop. It's basically three transcription factors. It's called A, B, and C. A regulates the expression of B, B regulates the expression of C, and A also regulates the expression of C. So you can do something, you can kind of characterize this topology into finer details by saying whether this relationship's activating or repressing. This one is repressing or activating or repressing, and this one. So if you do this classification, what you have is 8 different patterns. I'll draw some of them here. These are all activating. And this one is A activating C and A activating B. But B represses the expression of C. And in another case, well, say A represses the expression of C, repress the expression of B, B repress the expression of C. So when you count how often you can observe different topologies in the transcription factor network of E. coli and the transcription factor network of S. cerevisiae, an interesting phenomenon is that these two appears way more often than the others. And this is an interesting phenomenon, and people want to know why. So one argument is that these two guys, they have special dynamic activities. For example, this guy. If you think that the expression of gene C is determined, requires both the binding of A and B, then the fluctuation in gene C will be much lower when there is fluctuations in expression level of A, because now if unexpectedly A has a short increase in its expression level, then C, the expression of C would not increase immediately because B has to be built before C can be expressed. So put it in another way, if the increase in the expression level of A is long enough, then enough B can be built and C can be expressed. But if the expression level of A is very short, then not enough B can be produced, then the expression of C will be stopped. So now with our model, what we can ask is...
You have like 3 minutes.
Okay. In our model, what we can ask is, here's our model. The question is, if we throw this question to the model, give me resistance to fluctuation. We want the model to tell us these are the possible solutions. And if we ask a slightly different question by say, give us something irrelevant to resistance to fluctuation, and we may get some different solutions. And if we compare in the two solutions that both solutions we get we can observe roughly the same amount of this kind of pattern, then we can say that this phenomenon is not the result of adaptation. It's just maybe a byproduct of evolution. So I think that's it.
You have 2 minutes for questions.
Yeah.
So in a paper 10 years or more ago, Ron Milo showed that different kinds of regulatory networks have different frequencies for different kinds of 13 different kinds of possible three-node networks. Do you think those differences are adaptive, or if people showed those are adaptive, or do you think those might be the product of just the sort of null model that you're talking about?
I think you can certainly get the kind of distribution if you have the right amount of, say, gene duplication versus gene deletion rates. And that means they can arise from a non-adaptive process. But also, as you can see, this kind of explanation has its reasoning. So you cannot rule out the possibility that they are truly a result of adaptation. So to really answer the question, I think what I have to do is to put the question into the model and see what I can get.
Yeah. So I think your answer will depend to a large extent on what the sources of stochasticity are, right? So there's obviously one source, which is just the intrinsic noise, but presumably E. coli also experience stochasticity from the environment, right?
Yes.
And so that can be, so we don't know much about it. And so maybe one interesting question to ask is, how does external stochasticity actually determine
the frequency of this? You're absolutely right. So here, what I'm trying to do, the first step is to, because the intrinsic fluctuation is already a component of the network. So here, what I'm asking is the fluctuations to environmental, the resistance to environmental fluctuations, which, as the original argument says, that cause the fluctuations in A. Does that lead to the enrichment of this topology?
I'm actually not sure if there's going to be, in terms of fluctuations, any difference between the all activating and all repressing case.
You mean the A, R, C, R.
Why is that? From a symmetrical argument, that if you look at the all activating case and then the final product C goes and does something, versus if you think of the all repressive case, I mean, saying C goes and negates something, it seems to me like the exact same system.
That's one thing this model can model, because there are other arguments that trying to find more detailed explanations regarding the more dynamic properties between these different topologies, and use that to explain this distribution. And it may be the second step of this model I can test those.
I'm just saying, from the fluctuations, I can't imagine, off the top of my head, that those two would be separated in any way.
Yeah, that's something we can test.
Thank you very much. Our last speaker for this session today is Sebastian Furtkauer. He got his undergraduate degree at the Technical University of Vienna. He did his PhD with Frank Ulischer in
Dresden,
right? With Frank and with Stephen Grill, and he's now a postdoc working at NYU with Mike Shelley, but on a project in collaboration with Dan Needleman, who also was was here earlier in the program. And the title of Sebastian's talk is Active Gel Models for the Cytoskeleton.
Thanks for having me. I'm currently a postdoc with Daniel Needleman at Harvard and Michael Shelley at NYU, and these guys are paying. And I want to sort of tell you two stories that link the research that I did during my PhD with Frank and the research I'm doing now, which basically both have one principle in common, which is that phenotype on a cell biological level is often not very hard to quantify, because it is the result of the interaction of many, many proteins. So if we wanted to sort of track what all these proteins are doing, we would have to track thousands or ten thousands of agents, which in general we cannot do. However, we can learn from the physics of fluids, where instead of describing every water molecule that you would be interested in, you look at the thing from further away, and ask what is the allowed coarse-grained physics. And for something simple like water, it turns out that you can get away with describing the whole thing knowing force balance and one parameter, which is the viscosity of the thing, which you can then measure to determine whether you have water or oil. So an active fluid is basically a suspension of fluid in which you have particles embedded that move by themselves, that have access to a supply of energy that allows them to move by themselves. And examples for this could be something like microswimmers, microbes in a suspension, like these clammies here, or what I will be focusing on today, cytoskeletal assemblies, where you might have molecular motors which drag around microscopic filaments and in that way exert mechanical work, or do mechanical work in the system. I will focus on two examples. One is the cell cortex of the C. elegans embryo, and the other one is the spindle of Xenopus levis. I will start with the C. elegans cell cortex. So C. elegans is a millimeter long worm, is a hermaphrodite, and what you see in here, these cells here, are actually the egg cells as they mature. So what you can do now is rip this poor guy open and extract one of its eggs, and what you will find is about 50 microns long, 30 microns wide cell with an eggshell. Below the eggshell you have a membrane, and just below the membrane you have an actin cortex, which is basically a rapidly turning over assembly of actin polymers and molecular motors and actin binding proteins. So if you wanted to look at the thing, what you can do is you can take this cell and plate it between a glass cover slip and push it down with an agar pad, such that it's slightly flattened here, and look at what happens in this thin film here, which is pressed around the glass. What we tagged here is a myosin II, which for the purpose of this film, I want you to see as a sort of tracer particle. And what I hope this movie convinces you of is that this whole structure is very dynamic and sort of fluid-like. So we were not the first to argue that the cell cortex can be understood as an active fluid. But basically, the whole program of using active fluids to describe cytoskeleton, to describe these very complex phenotypes, is to sort of now find a simple physical description of what we see on this picture, and hopefully have this simple physical description also work if we change details of the exact molecular interactions that are going on, for instance, by knocking out parts of the molecular networks by RNAi. So as I told you, the project of basically summing up all the types of interactions to sort of getting at this seems to be so far out of our reach. However, we know something else. We know that the laws of physics hold, and independent of what this stuff actually is, and specifically conservation laws hold. So if I looked at a chunk of mystery matter here, the one thing that I know for sure is that the mass density in here will not change spontaneously. So if I have mass changing here, then it must flow in or out. That is what this first conservation equation tells you. The second thing that I know is if the momentum in here changes, so if this stuff here starts to move, at the low Reynolds number limit starts to move, then this means, or if the momentum changes, that then I have a force acting on here. Or the other way said, the momentum balance, the total momentum can only change by momentum flux, an active stress. And in the same way, the total angular momentum density here in the absence of external forces can only change by external torques. And what this tells you is if in a system like C. elegans, we know that we're not pushing this thing from outside, so there's no external forces or torques acting here, we see motion, that there must be ways of actively producing these stresses here or these angular momentum fluxes. So what we propose is happening in C. elegans is that actually you have a molecular motor called myosin which tends to pull on actin filament. So what this guy will do, it will pull on two actin filaments and exert equal and opposite forces. As you can see, the total force of this object is zero. So I don't push anything from the outside. All the physics still works out. However, I have two force monopoles that cancel. And now if you work out the math of the collective behavior of many such objects, you will find out that actually what these guys here collectively do is they produce an active stress in the fluid. Going back to the thin film, which is the cellular cortex, what this now means is that my actin filaments may actually set the material under tension. However, if I had the same tension everywhere, still nothing would move. As you can see, sort of these, my actin filaments pulling and generating tension just pull against each other. They might locally dissipate energy, but nothing will move. If, however, I had some other process which sort of regulated the amount of myosin that is active locally, what would happen is that I would have less tension at certain points in the cell cortex and more at others. Now I have a situation of force imbalance. This is not possible. I have no external forces, so I need to somehow compensate that. The easiest way of doing that is by moving stuff around and hoping that the viscosity in this motion will sort of set my force balance right. And that's actually what happens. So that's the formalized way of writing this statement. If I have a gradient in the tension and no external forces acting, the simplest way of accommodating this into my force balance is by having fluid flows where the viscous forces that correspond to that exactly balance this gradient here. And here I also have a friction term in the case of C. elegans because I have a solid eggshell against which I have a friction. That's where this comes from. So this makes a very specific prediction already, which is that in my C. elegans embryo, in the video you saw before, we would see flows from regions where there's less motors to regions where there's more motors. So let's watch the video again. The bright stuff tagged here are actually the motors. And what you see is that indeed, here in the darker regions, there's flow towards the brighter regions. So are we there yet? Not quite, because that's not the full story. Actually, if you look more carefully here, what you will see is that here you have also a flow downward, here you have a flow upward. It's not very convincing on this one movie. Let me show you one guy that we screwed up by RNAi. Here you really have very strong flows downwards, very strong flow upwards. And there's no protein gradient from here to here. So obviously I didn't tell you the full story yet. And obviously my model isn't complete. So the way we try to, and one interesting observation here is the direction of this rotation here is conserved between individuals. So this chirality seems to be set by a microscopic mechanism and is not the result of a spontaneous symmetry breaking, which means that there should be some chiral process at the origin. And one guess that we made is that actually the actin filaments in the cell cortex, they are helices with a conserved chirality. So you might very well think that your myosin, while pulling at these filaments, might also slightly twist them. And again, I don't have external torques, so whatever torque I exert here, I need to exert the equal and opposite torque here. And going through exactly the same logic as before, I can now see that collections of these objects will generate angular momentum fluxes in the material. In a thin film like the cortex, what this means is that now that I have my dipoles here, I can actually transport angular momentum from the outside world inside. The only thing that I need for that is for this surface here to be slightly different from this surface. In C. elegans, we know for sure that is the case. Here, there's a membrane and an eggshell. Here, there's cytosol. If you look at the gradients of proteins through the cortex, we know that they are highly anisotropically distributed. So we know that there's an asymmetry here. And what this now means is that your myosin motors can also exert a local torsion in the cell cortex. Now, as before, if you walked along a direction where you have the same concentration of myosin motors, the effects of this guy would exactly cancel against this guy. So nothing would move. However, if you compare in the direction where you have a gradient of motors, this guy here would now beat out this one, and you would now, by exactly the same mechanism as before, produce a flow in the direction orthogonal to the gradient of Meyerson motors. So with this, we converge to a theory that we now claim describes the motion of the cell cortex, which basically says that viscous flows and friction with the outside world exactly balance the force or the gradients of active stresses, contractile stresses, and the local torsion of the cell cortex. And that's a statement that we can now quantitatively test. So we go back to the same movie again. It takes many of those, divide those along in bins along the anterior-posterior axis, measure where our molecular motors are, and the units here are arbitrary units because we basically measure fluorescence. We can measure the flows along the anterior-posterior velocity, that's this curve. We can measure the flows along the y direction, that's this curve, and all of this data is averaged over like 50 embryos. And we can now hope that we can plug in this here into the T of the equation before and extract these two curves.
So how do you define your x and your y every time?
So I should have told it. So C. elegans is fertilized internally. So it's an egg-shaped object that gives you an axis. And the sperm, on average, or mostly, enters near this one pole, which then makes this pole, the posterior pole, different from this one. So there's a ton of biochemistry defining that this here is anterior, because this whole cell will divide asymmetrically, and this here will basically give rise to all the somatic tissue, and this here will be the germline. So it's set up in the organism, basically. So my claim is I can use this, plug it into my equation, and get these out. And indeed, I can. Obviously, there's two fit parameters in here. These are the phenomenological coefficients that I was after. These two parameters that I extract to make this fit, that's the phenotype. In my case, this is one length, which basically tells me if I locally squeeze my cortex, how far away can I feel it? And there's one dimensionless parameter, which tells me how much of the contractile process I have compared to the torsional process. And now my claim is I can now use this to play games and actually ask what happens if I keep making my ones unhappy by knocking out proteins or by making them evolve without selection like Dan did. So here what we did is we went through a whole list of actin binding proteins and could quantify their phenotypes. And these are fits to the different to some of these, just to show you that still we get a convincing agreement between theory and experiments in all the types. And I just want to point out one of the results which we now get out of this. What we found, interestingly, is some very strong implication of our model for how C. elegans actually breaks left-right symmetry. So most organisms are chiral. We have our heart to the left-hand side. And so C. elegans is chiral. It has a gap twist, which always twists one-handedness in all healthy organisms. However, there's one event in its life where you can actually build a mirror symmetric worm. That happens at the 4 to 6 cell stage, and two cells divide, and as they divide, they sort of twist with respect to the anterior-posterior axis. So now what Bill Wood did in the 90s is he took a needle, poked here, and slipped these guys the other way. What he got is a mirror symmetric adult worm. And what we knew before is that there's some set of proteins which would actually disrupt this natural twist of the spindle. And interestingly, what we found is that all the proteins that disrupt this also disrupt our one-cell stage chirality. And vice versa, all the proteins that upregulate or downregulate one-cell stage chirality consistently upregulate or downregulate this twist. So we think that we now have pretty strong circumstantial evidence that one-cell stage chirality, the fact that the cell cortex can produce torques, which was not known before, actually helps these types of organisms break left-right symmetry on an organismal level. this is perfect in time. So basically what I showed you so far is that active fluid models can actually help you to develop a relatively simple description with very few parameters of the emergent properties of a cytoskeletal organelle, which now allows you to quantitatively say what a phenotype on a cell biological level is and play all kinds of games. So here we played more with the RNAi, but you can, of course, and I think that's why this is useful for you, for the audience here, play all kinds of evolutionary games, compare close organisms, or do in vitro evolution experiments. And the most important cell biological result that fell out of this is that the actin cytoskeleton can generate torques, and that these torques seem to be at least one-to-one correlated with the left-right symmetry breaking of the embryo in later stages. So does anyone want to ask questions before I switch gear to the second example?
Does the myosin actually walk around the actin if you look at it?
So the story is slightly more complicated. Myosin 2 is a non-processive motor. So what we do know is that if you have myosin 2, you attach it to a glass cover slip in vitro and put actin filaments on top of it, you can follow a fluorophore rotate around the thing. However, these guys do not walk along the helix. They just give it kicks. Yeah, okay. And where they grab to the helix depends on the growth of the helix.
It's always rotating in the same direction.
It's always rotating in the same direction. In vivo, the situation is even more complicated because myosin forms minifilaments, which are then sort of more processive.
That's good.
But okay, then let me switch gear. The second organism.
Give a little more than 10 minutes.
The second organism that I want to talk about is Xenopus levis, and particularly about one part of this guy, which are its eggs. So the experiment that we can do in the lab that we want to understand is if you can get Xenopus levis to lay eggs, crush these eggs, and spin out basically everything that's heavier than water, or that's solid. And you get a clear fluid, supernatant liquid, which basically contains the same protein mixture that a meiotic Xenopus egg would contain. What you can then do is add any kind of DNA on a bead, or some people also use demembranated Proxper. And what you will see is that over the course of like 30 minutes, around the DNA, which is not tagged, but which sits somewhere here in this picture, there's like a 50 micron long football shaped object that self-assembles, which is mostly made of microtubules and molecular scale motors. And what John Bruges has shown in Dan Needleman's lab has shown is that these microtubules actually survive a turnover very rapidly. So while this total object can stay static in frogs in vitro for as long as we have ATP around, in humans where we have a very similar object in the egg cells, they are stored in females for like 40 years, so as long as the whole system survives. So basically the question that we wanted to ask is, can we now take the same kind of logic where we think of the system on a very far removed, far from the molecular scale level, borrowing the tools of what we know of the physics of fluids, and understand how does this thing figure out how to get 50 microns long, 30 microns wide, and assemble to this shape? And we made a hypothesis, which was basically triggered by the fact that if you have a droplet of oil in water, it will be round. Basically, if you have a droplet of anything in water that is fluid, and your molecules have an affinity for each other, there will be a surface tension. This would give you a round droplet. The second thing that we knew is that, again, we would have molecular motors which slide filaments past each other. In this case, these motors are several families of kinesins and dynaenes, and the filaments are microtubules, but basically the cartoon that I showed you before should hold. So we hypothesized that just by doing this, you would generate extensile stresses which would then compete against the surface tension and form your spherical bubble that would be held together by surface tension into a football. This model sort of makes a prediction, even before I show you any math about it, which is that if I could now sort of switch off the turnover and really have solid rods, just have the motor still keep doing their thing and plate this somewhere, if I start with a little fluid, this should expand, and then if it's confined, you would have continuous flows. So we set out to try this idea. And Peter Foster in Dan Nielsen's lab came up with an experiment to actually do this. So what he did is he took the same supernatant frog extract and added a cancer drug, which is called Taxol. So what Taxol does is it stabilizes microtubules. Microtubules will instantaneously nucleate and then stay what they are, stay stable. And then he would sort of take his mixture, put it into a thin chamber, and run through the microscope as fast as he could. And that's what he would have done. So the labeled stuff here is now tubulin. This chamber is like 1.5 millimeters wide and infinitely long, and like 200 microns out of the board, narrow. So what he sees is that the microtubules instantaneously assemble into a film, and this film is highly contractile. So obviously our initial hypothesis was falsified. So we had to come up with something better, which in this case was what we then saw is that if we had a molecular motor around which preferentially bound to one end of microtubules, the microtubules have two ends which are structurally really different, and like to collect this end, that this actually could give you contractile stresses. So the key idea would then be that motors dragged minus ends of microtubules together, which would give you a contractile stress, which is proportional to the number of motors. However, if the density of microtubules around would be too high just by dragging this guy through the seed, it would sterically push other guys out of the way. That would give you an extensile stress which goes with rho squared. So you would converge to a preferred density. And plugging this in a simple model for two fluids in a thin chamber, you now get a quantitative prediction of what should happen. So what we then did is we went back to these movies and others of this kind and measured how this width and the fluorescence intensity along this direction here changed over time. That's the wiggly curves here. What we could then do is take sort of our initial time point from this movie and plug this in as initial state of this set of dynamic equations. And as you can see, if I now match the dynamics from my super simplified fluid dynamics, remember, all the proteins that are in the spindle are in here and do their thing. The only thing that switched off is microtubule nucleation depolymerization. So apparently, we can quantitatively describe this very complex dynamics in terms of just 3-4 parameters. The other thing that we could do, which I haven't shown you here for the sake of time, is we could actually identify this guy. Because we can now inhibit different candidate motors. And so by now, we're pretty sure that this is binene doing the job. And so finally, let me go back to showing how this should, in the future, inform our thoughts about the spindle. What we can now do is basically take the equations from the slide before, where we now sort of have an idea what this material does from a force and stress point of view, and add in a model that tells us where microtubules would appear and disappear in an in vivo context. And for the sake of time, I won't go into the details, but basically what we think is that around the chromosome, there is nucleator molecules being activated. These nucleator molecules would bind to microtubules, which would lead to microtubules growing off other microtubules. And then we know that microtubules depolymerize spontaneously with a rate which is something like 1 over 17 seconds from measurements. The last thing that we need to put in is that microtubules actually like to align. So what happens is that the flows created by a stress model will now tend to push microtubules around. So we need to put in something that keeps them aligned, which we can also take from the literature on fluids. And we can put all of this together and try to solve it in silico. And what I'm showing you here is preliminary data. This is an experiment and not from the Needleman lab. So these are Tim Mitchinson's, from Tim Mitchinson's group. And what I hope that this movie can sort of convince you about is that we are close, that we're qualitatively capturing this assembly process, although many of the details are not yet what we would want them to be. But I think we're getting towards a phenomenological physical model for the spindle. And then again, this will allow to ask very interesting questions. There's very related frog species, Xenopus tropicalis, this is Xenopus laevis, where if you looked at this scale, the spindle would look very similarly. However, this protein here, which is the cascade of the nucleation cascade, seems not to be there in tropicalis. In Lewis, nothing happens without this guy. And there's tons of these questions with them, so all of a sudden pop up that we hope that we can access. So what I showed you here, we are in the process of developing a theory for describing the Xenopus laevis spindle. Our key result so far is that actually in the spindle materials, stresses are contractile and depend on a molecular motor called dynein. And now we hope that together with a model that explains microtubule polymerization, we can get something that is quantitatively accurate in describing this organelle.
So which parameters determine the scale of the spindle in your model, this last model?
So in the version of the model from which I pulled the movie, this size here would basically be proportional to the number of nucleators, which seems to be consistent with many experimental observations. So basically, what seems to be setting the size in spindles is you have one mechanism that keeps the distribution kind of flat, then you have how much you nucleate or how much material you get per nucleation event, and then you have a turnover rate. But what seems to be highly regulated is how much nucleation events you have spatially. What this model in its naive form doesn't do yet is the spindle actually has a very sharp interface, so the density is highly controlled. Our mechanism doesn't do that yet for realistic parameters, so there's stuff that we are missing. But I think the answer is the number of nucleators controls how big this thing is.
Any idea how like attachment of GFP will affect your result in terms of the size shift? Because you're attaching to actin and tubulin, which in terms of GFP size and...
So I don't think that there's on this scale, any differences that we are aware of between like DIC movies and GFP tagged?
This is pretty large protein GFP.
So this whole structure here is 50 microns long, and the microtubules.
You have the whole polymer, and you have for each of the tubulin you have GFP attached,
I don't think that this is 100% labeling. So every once in a while you have some.
But still a lot of them.
But I think the best answer that I can give you is that we are not aware of any physiological differences between the labeled spindles and the ones that are looked at.
It looks like typically not 100%. It's actually way below 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So you're mixed with dark.
Mm-hmm. And you do this exact same thing in vivo in cells, and they're fine. If you make it all GFP tubulin, I think they're pretty sick. Yeah. But you can just put in enough that you can see, mm-hmm. and it doesn't seem to affect their overall growth. Okay.
So I just wondering, I guess Laevis has twice the number, roughly twice the genome size, I suppose, of how the
Tell me.
I think so. Because it's a saprophyte. Well, I guess I was wondering what's the sensitivity to the whole thing if you were to double the amount of DNA substrate.
So one experiment that people have done is that they take several of these and then they push them together. And it's actually really fascinating. So what they do is that they sort of put them together, and what you will see is that the spindle first rotate, then they sort of slide over each other. And the total volume of the spindle roughly scales with the amount of DNA, which means that the size that you would see here only very weakly scales with it. Which I think is a signature of the fact that at chromatids, you sort of have this process which activates the mystery nucleator going on. Maybe a little bit dampened by the fact that you have sort of stuff that's diffusion. Between the species. So between Tropicalis and Lavis, one thing that is kind of striking is that in Lavis, the spindle, the tubulin concentration seems to be very homogeneous, whereas if I remember right, in Tropicalis, you sort of get a gap of tubulin near the chromosomes. So it really looks like you sort of have a dip. The second thing is the Tropicalis spindle is smaller, which might be consistent with what you are saying. But then again, we know that this process, which does it in Lavis, seems not to be important in Tropicalis. So I don't know. I think we can only guess.
Great. OK, well, I think we should give another